This is the Dave Durant Show with Dave Durant. Welcome to the Dave Durant Show, where faith and the workplace meet. We discuss the tips, tools, and resources to help you become a better leader in the workplace, in your business, and in your home. And as always, I'm joined by our host, Dave Durant. Stick around to the end for some listener Q&A. Feel free to send your questions over to dave@leadinggiants.com. We'll take a look at them and answer them here on the radio. Today, we're going to go over the five reasons entrepreneurs fail. And for the extended version of this, you can head over to Dave's YouTube channel, Durant On Demand, and we'll have an extended version of each one of these points. So the five reasons entrepreneurs fail. Dave, what is the first on the list?
The first on the list, and these are in no particular order. In fact, as I get down to the fifth one, that might be the weightiest one. The interesting thing about this, Nico, is that each person, according to their own natural gifts that they bring to the table, will suffer from one of these or the other. So you might be a person who's like, oh, I don't do one, I don't do two, I don't do three, I don't do four. Oh, five, although you probably would not admit that you do five. Okay, and you'll know what I mean when I get there. The first one is creating problems. This is absolutely a problem. Self-inflicted injury you see happen to entrepreneurs on a regular basis. You can imagine if an athlete, a professional athlete, were to wake up in the morning and take a hammer and hit his Achilles tendon. I mean, why would anybody do that? That's going to take them out of the game. But in some way or another, we have a tendency to do these sorts of things as human beings, and particularly as I'm talking about entrepreneurs. Now, I do want to be very clear about something. If you're not an entrepreneur, but you're a leader of any type, most of these are going to apply in one way or another to what you're doing. So you don't need to tune out if you haven't started or built your own company. If you're leading anything, these are going to apply. But the first one is creating problems. Those problems are physical, relational, financial, and addictions. And I see this all the time. In 35 years of building businesses and leading entrepreneurs, it is a tragedy when something happens physically to a person that they didn't actually self-inflict, whether it's an accident or something like that. But when people do these things to themselves, you see tremendous regret in the person. Quite often you'll see the person is an alcoholic or smoked, and they just can't free themselves from the addiction. And I have tremendous empathy for this, by the way. So I'm not making a judgment. I'm making an analysis, which is a very different thing, because a person who's stuck in an addiction like that really just needs prayer, compassion, and help. You know, there may be somebody in their life that needs to give them the tough love side of it, but that's not my job. So what happens, though, is when they know this was self-inflicted and now they all of a sudden are at this place where they have disease and they are trying to turn this around, you can see this like overwhelm kind of hit them like, wow, the seriousness of this circumstance, if I could change it and go back, I would. I would regret this. So it's something to keep in mind. But there are more subtle things than those bigger ones, like just constantly eating unhealthy foods and carbohydrates and therefore gaining weight. Now we can see that, oh, wow. Oh, Dave, are you talking about self-inflicted problems for entrepreneurs, like somebody having a heart attack? Well, yeah. Somebody having cancer because of what they've done in their diet. Sure, I am, but I'm actually talking about other things that are more pervasive than those that become very big at the end like that. The pervasive things that take place would be low energy, foggy brain, slowness because of bad diet, because of addictions. Those things really become problematic. So you want to think of yourself in optimal health. You know, what's so crazy is people will pay attention to their car like, oh, I got to change the oil. You know, like I just went over 3,000 miles. I feel the empathy and pain of my car because I'm at 3,001 mile. By the way, isn't even really true itself. You can go much longer than that. But anyway, so I'm going to take care of that. My Keurig needs to be descaled. So they're on it because they just can't let equipment not operate effectively. They're updating their computers all the time. But yet they're literally feeding their body something that actually is the thing that drives the car, that uses the Keurig and uses the computer. But they're feeding it like sand in its gas tank, and just destroying its ability to operate at an optimal level. So you have to think about optimal performance. Optimal performance doesn't mean, oh, you know, trying to be like the beach body or these different types of things, but it's to say, how can I have prime effectiveness in what I do? Relationships, you see this too. there are some tragic things that happen in a relationship, because if you have a one-on-one relationship with somebody, you only have 50% of the power in that relationship. You can't control the other person. But when a person self-inflicts and they're the one that's causing strain in the relationship, either by harming the relationship with selfishness, whatever, you know, bad, poor behaviors and activities, this is very, very problematic. And it's very avoidable. And these things take people out of the game all the time. Now, you may say, oh, it took the person out of the game because all of a sudden now they went through a divorce and they were struggling and they entered into depression. And so they're literally out of the game for a month or two or a year or whatever. Yes, that is also very true. But I'm talking about the pervasive stuff, which is the strain of the relationship on a daily basis, even before it hits that level. See, when a person is in that sort of strain and you want to sit down and talk to them about a marketing meeting or, you know, ordering some product or supplies or arranging something, they're saying to themselves, this is so unimportant compared to what I'm actually dealing with when I go home that I can fake enthusiasm for it, but I'm really not that interested in it. If we're going to be effective in the workplace, we have to try to get the rest of our life actually in order. And we also have to understand this about work. Our work heals the rest of our life. Nobody's ever said, my financial life was out of order, and so I neglected my work and it got better. My relationships are out of order, so I neglected my work and they got better. Even my physical health, sure, sometimes we have to pay attention to acute circumstances to take us out of the game. But for the most part, our work heals relationships because we are more productive. We feel better about ourselves. We're more respected. We're contributing in a way. It heals our physical health because if we take it seriously, this is one of these, you know, is it correlation or causation? In fact, I did commentary a little while ago on how the wealthiest people in the United States are married with children. And how a lot of people will advocate this. Oh, if you want to build your wealth, stay single until you're 35 and then you'll have your wealth and then get married. And when I said, hey, listen, and I just quipped it. I wasn't like literally deliberately saying this, but I said, hey, really, if you want to be rich, even if you don't like kids get married and have kids anyway, because you're going to be wealthier just by way of demographic. Well, I had somebody say, well, this is a great example of correlation, not causation. But it really actually isn't. And the reason that it isn't is because when you are married with kids, it causes you to behave in a way that increases your level of responsibility. So this is one of those unusual things where you can scientifically say that correlation is true, but so is causation to a degree. And so it's a little bit more in depth than just saying it's one or the other. Okay. When it comes to creating problems, the problems that we get into do start to get in the way of the solutions that we have in the workplace. So we have to just remember that, we want to have our life in order so that we don't have to deal with the additional stresses of life when we're entering into the workplace. We can just get things done. Because frankly speaking, you're going to have problems in life no matter what, even if you're behaving the right way, even if you're eating the right way, even if you're exercising the right way. And we just don't want to self-inflict them. And I've just noticed also that the self-infliction of these things creates a greater level of stress than when they just kind of happen to occur to us, because the guilt from bringing them on ourselves, it takes some mind share. It rents space in our heads.
Definitely been there and done that. And, it's funny. It's, you had a great video recently on 7 keys or 7 steps to become a man in your 20s, from boy to man. And I think you touch on a few of these things. Not creating those problems for yourself is implicit in that video. Definitely recommend, for our listeners to check that out on Dave's YouTube channel. But without getting too distracted here on the conversation, Dave, what is the second reason why entrepreneurs fail?
They're cowards in regards to facing the truth. Now, a lot of people talk about, okay, well, you know, you can just be afraid as an entrepreneur, but I would, I like to provide advice or analysis that is usable. So when somebody says something like you need to believe to achieve, or you need to be more courageous, if I don't know how to do that, I don't know. Well, what do I do with that? Like, just, okay, convince myself I'm courageous when I'm not? No. So I like to show people how to get there and where the actual root problem is. Almost all of the fear that we have when we're about to enter into an entrepreneurial idea or to take risk comes from the fact that we're afraid of the truth. So we're either closed-minded or naively open-minded. the naively open-minded person is like, oh, I'm going to be great at this. I'm just going to run this great business. You have advice for me? Great. Let me just take your advice. Why? Because you're an advice giver. I also mentioned this, by the way, in the video, people at 20s is like, is reading good? And, you know, the like reflexive response is yes, no. Reading is only good if you're reading good material by good authors. Otherwise, reading is really, really bad and it's going to poison your brain. So it's the same sort of thing. Like, what are you being open-minded to? Who's giving you the advice? Where does it come from? Is it actually effective? Or are they just spouting out things because they want to feel important and you're prime bait for them as a charlatan, you know? So don't be afraid of the truth. A lot of the truths that are out there are related to your ability to do something, the viability of your product or service. I'm going to get into those things in a little bit. But they are also things that have to do with like the overall worldview and market view. So a lot of this in today's day and age happens to be like political, like on the left or the right. Like in order to run a great business, our great business needs to adopt these leftist philosophies. Okay, because otherwise we're going to be shunned and people aren't going to like us. Or on the other hand, a person is like, in order for me to do well, I need to fight against everything that the people on the other side of the fence say. And so I'm going to be ultra this or ultra that. That generally doesn't work. Now, you've heard me say before, Nico, that being extreme actually is good. Okay, but directing your extremeness toward the right things is the thing that matters. Like if you are extreme about something totally irrelevant or you're extreme about something completely wrong, that's bad extreme. But if you are extreme about having a high level of success, extreme about having a high standard, extreme about your schedule so that you can be effective in what you do, you know, extreme about the truth, that matters. Okay. Then you're going to do well. But you can't be afraid of the truth. You can't be afraid of data when it hits you. You can't be afraid to hire somebody because you think that they have a political opinion that is different than yours and that automatically that's going to discredit them from every single thing they do in the workplace. It's just not true.
All right, Dave Durant Show listeners, sorry to interrupt, but we have to take a quick commercial break and we will be right back with the 5 mental blockers that cause entrepreneurs and leaders to fail and how to avoid them here at the Dave Durant Show.
This is the Dave Durant Show with Dave Durant.
All right, and welcome back, everyone, to the Dave Durant Show. We are back with the 5 mental blockers that cause entrepreneurs and leaders to fail. And as a quick reminder, you can actually get the full extended version, visual experience of this particular segment on Dave's YouTube channel, Durand On Demand, where he goes into the specifics of each one of these 5 mental blockers. But without further ado, here are the remaining 3.
All right, Dave, what is point number 3 on the 5 reasons entrepreneurs fail?
It sounds like this. I'm the best. Nobody can do what I do. Oh, my goodness. I see this one at such an unbelievably high level. This is not a peripheral thing. This is not a small thing. This is not an out there thing, you know, like a fringe sort of thing. This is usually the solopreneur. The solopreneur is the person who, you know, they're the marketing person, the salesperson, they produce everything. They're the accountant. They're the janitor. They're doing every role. And they're so fond of themselves that they don't think anyone can do anything. Like they can't even clean the toilets as good as me. You know, they can't do the accounting as good as me. They can't do the selling as good as me. You know what? Every single thing that you're doing, even the thing that you're the specialist in, somebody can do better. There's no doubt about it. Somebody can do it better. And you see this trap. It's a long-term reason that people fail. A solopreneur can usually stay in the dissatisfaction of the grind for a period of time because in order to say nobody can do this like me, you have to have an enormous amount of pride. And that pride gets them to not quit, which does get them to like try to prove to the rest of the world they were right for doing the idea in the first place. But it also makes them like victims, which is a very, very juxtaposition. Because generally speaking, the entrepreneur who takes on responsibilities themselves has a completely different attitude than a victim attitude. But here it shows up as a victim attitude. Why does it show up that way? Well, because nobody's good at this like me. So I have to do everything myself. Now, I'm a victim of the world's circumstance. You know what I'm a victim of? I'm a victim of being the only perfect person around here. And I suffer from perfectness because I'm around everybody else's imperfection. And eventually they quit. For the most part, the person who has become addicted to this mentality for a really long period of time, they're hard to convert. The conversion of this person has to come early, generally speaking, to heal them. It can come later, but it mostly comes early. Okay. But if you want to free yourself from that, I'll help you and I'll show you how other people can do it better. But this idea that nobody can do what you do is abundantly wrong. I've given the example many times. In fact, there are a lot of examples. I'll give another one. I remember one time I had an employee. It wasn't even a partner. It wasn't somebody else. They were convincing me 24 hours a day that their job was super hard to do and they couldn't get it done. They needed a full-time assistant in order to get it done. And I knew what the role was so well. And finally, I just had to let him go. And there's a conversation I've had with several people where I'm like, listen, just so you know, the more that we're sitting down and you're telling me you can't do your job, I'm telling you you can do your job. I believe in you. You're telling me that it can't be done. And I just want you to know that by the time we're done with this conversation, one of us is going to be right. And if you convince me you can't do your job, I got to let you go and find somebody who can do it. So just be careful with how enthusiastically you're convincing me you can't do your job. And I hired, she was a college graduate, by the way, with like 8 years of working experience. I hired a 19-year-old who was in tech school part-time. They worked 20 hours a week, not full-time. And literally by Tuesday at like halfway through the day, they said, okay, I did everything on the list. I looked at the quality of their work. They got done more in a day and a half than the person did full-time with higher quality work. And it's just, it's that easy. Well, it's not always that easy, but I should say that when you want to prove something is hard, you always hold the trump cards and you can make it look super hard even when it's not.
Moving on to the five reasons entrepreneurs fail. What is number four, Dave?
You just can't find good people. Now, this, I suppose, is related to the idea that I'm the best. Nobody can do what I can do. But when people say you just can't find good people, they also say things like, or trust them. You know, everybody's out to rip you off. Everybody's out to get you. You know, if you try to find a good person, they're just going to quit. They're not going to be responsible. This is actually really detrimental for a person to say, because without knowing it, to a person who has been effective and successful as an entrepreneur, the effective, successful entrepreneur knows exactly what's actually taking place when they say that. And what they're really saying is, I'm a poor leader. I cannot attract people. I cannot train them effectively. I cannot effectively delegate. I can't inspire them and I can't retain them. And straight up, I'm going to tell you right now, if you are saying you just can't find good people and you can't trust them, this is really on you. Now, it doesn't mean it's easy to do, and it doesn't mean that because you're a successful entrepreneur, you can wave a magic wand and put an ad out there online for people to respond to, and the first person that comes in, you can just, you know, find them and have them do well. I mean, Nico, to find you, I went through tons of interviews, and I just couldn't find a really good fit. The difference between the entrepreneur that fails and succeeds is the entrepreneur that fails therefore says, you can't find good people. End of story. And I was like, no, I know they're out there. There's going to be someone. Look at how big the world is. And then all of a sudden, here you appear. Now, it could have turned out that you were not who you said you were and that you wouldn't have been getting the job done. And if that would have been the case, it would have been hugely disappointing. But I would have had to find somebody else and get the job done. And that's just what you do. But the person who fails at this never would have found you in the first place, because they would have not even placed the ad or reached out to people to try to find somebody. And if they did, the first person that comes along that they don't like, they think that they represent everybody on earth, or the first person that they hire, if they work out, represents how all people are bad. And these things are just not true.
So what is the fifth reason here for five reasons that entrepreneurs fail, Dave?
It's related to I'm the best and nobody can do what I can do, but it has to do with their ideas. My marketing approach is the best approach. My product idea is the best approach. My service idea is the best approach. I have been working with somebody who's driving me crazy. Not in my own company. They're They were contracted to build a facility that I have. And this particular person, and I would always protect somebody's make it anonymous in this, but is horrible to work with because they do all of these things. They're gravely irresponsible. They're so unorganized that they miss meetings. They don't write notes down. They're constantly saying, "You never told me that." So you're constantly having to re-show them the text, re-show them the email, which proves that you actually did. So they're unorganized. They're irresponsible. They're totally dishonest. They lie all the time. You cannot trust anything that they're doing. Now, that's one thing. The flabbergasting thing is that when you interact with other people who interact with this particular person, including his partner, they will tell you that these are the behaviors of this person universally with everyone. And at a certain point, people are a little hoodwinked. You know what he actually said to me? He said, "I warned you when you signed the contract that he would be this way." Like, to his own detriment as a partner, he was warning me against doing something. That is a fascinating circumstance to be in as a partner. The point to this is that it is well known with anybody who works with this person, and he just happened to have a product that I needed in the place, or a facility in the place that I needed it, and access to things to get it done, or I wouldn't have, the warning signs would have been like, okay, I'm just not going to do this. But I decided, well, it's probably my only choice. I'm going to try to do this as best I can, at least a choice for the efficiency that I needed. So I went into it. All of that is a way of building up to when I finally had conflict with this person. I said, "Just so you know, this conflict is not going to happen anymore. This is how this is going to take place, to the detriment of this person's situation from a legal perspective, because we'd been pushed to that level." He said, "Dave, just so you know, everyone likes me. Everyone loves the work that I do. Nobody ever says what you're saying or complains about it. I will tell you, to a mark of perfection, there is not a single person I've interacted that interacts with him." And this is quite a few people, who has ever admired the work that he does, and who doesn't like almost set each other off where you have to go, "You know what? Let's just not be emotional about this and calm down and let's just get the job done. We already know the facts about this person. It doesn't do any good to like gossip or be angry. Let's just get the job done." But it's difficult when you're around all sorts of people who are equally frustrated by it, because you want to kind of vent, but it elevates the frustration of venting. The reason this is so important is because he thinks his ideas are so good in the midst of everybody saying they are not. And these are ideas about organization and everything else too. I think it is a very good idea for us not to be the judge of the quality of our work. When I get done with a speech or a book and somebody says, "What do you think of it?" I'm like, well, I'm not the one to ask. Like, literally, you have to ask the people that I presented to. They have a much better way of telling. Here's who you don't ask. Don't ask my immediate family members, okay? And don't ask me, because we're biased. Ask the people who don't know me, who happen to come by and see what I had to provide, and they'll tell you. And then you have to conform it to that. Now, that's not true on all things, like particularly the speech. I mean, if your speech was about how people need to make change and people don't like being called to making change, they're going to say, "I hated your speech." Why? Because it reflected on who they are and what they need to do. So there are certain circumstances where feedback is valuable because it's negative. That means you did your job. But then there are other times where the feedback, you know, needs to be positive as an affirmation you did your job effectively.
And that is the 5 reasons entrepreneurs fail. This is the Dave Durant Show. We'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to the Dave Durant Show. This is our Q&A segment here. Send those questions over to Dave at dave@leadinggiants.com. We take a look at them and we answer them here live on the radio. You're more than welcome to also touch base with Dave on LinkedIn. In fact, he has some cool posts there every day, pretty much Monday through Friday. So definitely encourage you to follow Dave on LinkedIn. Now, Dave, we have a question from Matthew. Matthew says, "Dear Dave, I see roles at my business that I'd like to advance into, but I'm not certain I can do those jobs. How do you know if you're being ambitious or being practical when it comes to going to the next level?"
So I do have insight on this question list a little bit more than what you said, because Nico, I gave a presentation speech just the other day, and one of the audience members actually asked this question in Q&A, so I can dive into a little bit more. What I can tell you is that in talking to this person, I kept asking further questions, and I just said, listen, you don't have to worry about ambition. Ambition is not your problem. Now, I want to be clear about denotation and connotation on the word ambition, because if people aren't familiar with my material, they might be confused saying, well, isn't ambition good? Drive is good. And if you're using the word ambition and you mean drive, yeah. And I'm not going to slice up whether or not you should use the word ambition or drive. If they mean the same thing, which means that I am driven to get things done, and so I'm going to work diligently to do that, fine, then use the word ambition. But if you really want to be technical about ambition, ambition is actually to aspire to something that you're not qualified to. It's to want recognition for things that you do not merit, or to have positions and power in areas where you're just not going to get anything. I talked to somebody who was in a homeowners association circumstance recently, and they were talking about the president of their homeowners association. And I have enough intimate information on this to know how accurate they were saying is that the president of the homeowners association literally shakes people's hands. And he's 67 years old, by the way, and is retired, shakes people's hands. And when he meets him, says, "I was a gifted child. I went to a gifted school," and then goes on to talk about how amazingly gifted he was. He's never been in charge of anything like at an entrepreneurial level. He's always been like kind of a good employee of organizations. And there's a type. I know this type. And so now they're actually in charge of something. They've never been in charge of anything. And they're just, they love their power. And they think all the decisions they make are good. This particular person, people in the community want to lynch him. Like, if you think of like all of the bad decisions that a person can possibly make regarding like their fitness center and like their restaurant and club and everything in it, like he personally thinks, well, I think the hours should be this. And I don't think that type of music should be played there. And I think at the pool we should do this. And I think at the fitness center we should do this. This is a person who's probably never been at a pool, never walked into a gym, certainly doesn't have a lot of parties or friends over at parties at all, because every single thing that he thinks of is universally bad. It is the type of thing where you could have like 99 out of 100 people all line up and say, should we do it this way? 99 would say no, and one would say yes, and it's him. He's not going to get reelected. That I'm almost certain, unless people are just not paying attention. That is ambition. It is to believe that you are so qualified when you are utterly unqualified in every single way. This person has no problem with ambition. Why? How did I identify this? Well, in a further conversation, but I had an intuition about him not having ambition right away, because reread his question again. This is, you can see it in the way he asked the question.
He says, "I see roles at my business that I'd like to advance into, but I'm not certain I can do those jobs."
Ah, that's it right there. Uh-huh. No ambitious person says, "But I'm not certain I can do those jobs." They don't do that. They go, "I absolutely can do it, and I can do it better than everybody else." Okay. When you're asking the question, "I don't know if I can do it," when you have like little bits of what would be considered healthy self-doubt, because those are the healthy self-doubts that gets you to say, "I am going to ready myself. So if I'm not certain I'm strong enough for this, I will get stronger. If I don't have the knowledge for it, I will get the knowledge." Come to find out, by the way, this was a farm kid when he was younger. He worked super hard. Like, this is, the more you get to know the person, the more you're like, don't worry about this. I've actually learned too, that mostly people who are ambitious from their youth, and they remain ambitious throughout their lifetime. And they can be healed from it, okay, because human beings have a remarkable way of being able to recognize bad behaviors lead to bad outcomes and make change all on their own. If you add to the fact that God can do anything when grace moves, that's a totally different thing too, which is even more powerful. So people can change from this, but the longer they build the habit of affirming their own rightness and affirming their own awesomeness and everybody else's wrongness and lameness, the more they move away from ever being able to reconcile the idea that other people have better ideas than them. And they become more and more and more ambitious because they become exceedingly jealous of anybody who has more authority or power that they have. And so they live in this kind of false world where their view of themselves is, here's how I envision it. When you interact with them, I met somebody who did, he actually said this. Okay. This was actually when my son was in college. Okay. And I met some of his friends, some of his roommates. They're walking along and one of them says, yes, I can't wait to have my own home because I'm going to have a painting done of me in a loincloth, defeating a tiger with my bare hands. And we all laughed. And he said, why are you laughing? And we said, well, because that's funny. I mean, you know, that's like one of the most arrogant things that anybody would ever actually do. He didn't understand why we laughed at it. And so we actually thought that then he was kidding about kidding, like he was like deadpan. And he wasn't. He was like, yes, that is how I perceive myself. And I will definitely put that painting up there. Where are you doing that in your life? That's my question. I have to ask myself the same question. Where am I doing that in life? Like, I love going to confession as a Catholic. And if you're listening, you're not a Catholic. I got to tell you, one of the reasons I love it is because your examination of conscience is pretty amazing. You like literally have to say, okay, I have pride and I have vanity. And here's where it shows up. I don't have to tell my audience where I have pride and vanity. They already know. They can see it. They can see it easier than I can. But we have these things and we have to get past them.
Yeah, that's a great way to distinguish between ambition and drive for Matthew. And if you have any follow-up questions, Matthew, feel free to send them to dave@leadinggiants.com. Moving forward to another question that we got from Jessica. This is actually in response to one of your LinkedIn posts, Dave, where you say, great decision-making involves three initial steps, desiring what is good, knowing what is real, and pursuing what is good. So she asked, what if you have one in three and you don't know how to know what is real when you don't know what you don't know because they are liars, thieves, and shallow people without hurting innocent people involved too? This is where an action paralysis and goes far beyond patience. Just rewording the question a little bit here. She says, how does one gain a clear understanding of the facts when so much is not good, true, or real? I truly be grateful for any advice or further comment.
All right. I like this question because, okay, so just to go back, the post is about prudence. Okay. Prudence is the mastery of decision-making. It is the foundational virtue in the cardinal virtues. And the word cardinal is the Latin word for hinge, meaning that all other virtues hinge upon that. So any effective person in leadership or business or anywhere in life has to learn to master decision-making. And if you want to learn to master decision-making, you do it through the virtue of prudence. Now, what is a virtue? A virtue is kind of like the muscle of the intellect and the will. It is the thing that pulls human beings into excellence. And we want to be excellent decision-makers. There are three steps to prudence. The first is desire what is good, know what is real, and then pursue what is good. This is actually what her question is based upon. Well, desiring what is good is an important thing, but see, she's talking about, okay, if I'm working with other people, this is different. This isn't just like me saying, here I am an employee, or here I am, I'm a part of something. I desire what is good for this relationship. I desire what is good for this job. I'm going to make a meal. I desire what is good for the meal and the people eat it. She's saying, how do I know they desire what is good? How do I know that what they're saying to me is real and that they're going to pursue something real and good? There's two different ways that you can do this. One is experience. That is like the classic school of hard knocks. Over and over again, you start to recognize patterns and you say, when a person says this and they behave that way, I'm noticing a pattern. Now, there's something that would be the opposite of that, and that would be becoming jaded. A jaded person goes through an experience where a person says one thing, they were insincere about it, or they lied, they didn't know reality, and they hurt you. And now you're jaded. And no matter what somebody says, you don't believe them. That is different than experience that comes through a pattern. An experience that comes through a pattern is, sometimes when people say that, they mean it. Sometimes when they say it, they don't mean it. But there's a nuance in there. What is the nuance? So for example, you might have heard me say this before. I, in business, am very skeptical of the person who says, I have a Christian company, trust me. very skeptical. I'm not jaded. There are some people who are just very sincere people. They love Jesus. And so they want to put out there that they have a Christian company and they're doing it more or less to evangelize. And that's good. That's a very real thing. But first of all, just by way of marketing, I don't know what value it provides. That is one thing that I would say. Frankly speaking, I don't know that Jesus and the apostles would ask us to do that. I don't know that. I am me. This is Dave Durant's opinion. That's all it is. I actually think that Jesus, as a carpenter, would have said, "You know why you should buy our tables and chairs or whatever else we build as carpenters? It's because they are absolutely very, very good. We build them high quality. We build them with care. Don't buy them because I'm Jesus." And by the way, of anyone who could say, "I am a Christian company," it would be Jesus Christ, our Savior. I think that he would want the merits of the quality of the product and the reasonability of the price associated to that to be the reason that you would actually buy it. Now, he was all, he was human and God. So maybe the fact that you know him or you're his neighbor or you know his mother, I'm counting on knowing his mom to get all sorts of favors done. Okay. Those things are probably real, but I think it would have been quality. And I think that people if they go too far with buy from me because I'm Christian, you have to ask, well, what are you trying to make up for? Is it low quality? So I should look past that because you're a Christian? Are you dishonest, but you're telling me you're a Christian so that I don't pay attention to it? See, that's been my experience actually in this, is where people put out their "I'm a Christian company" and they use it actually as a juke in order to lie, cheat, and steal. And that's a bad thing. Now, a jaded person would say that all people who say they're a Christian company now must be using that to lie. That is totally unfair. There are just some really big-hearted, wonderful people who never really thought much about it. They want this to be a central part of who they are. So yeah, great. In that case, do business with them. Why? Because they have a high quality product and they love Jesus. What a great combination. So the jaded person would say, but because one person used this as a manipulation, all people do. That's a very bad idea. So instead, what you do is you look at the pattern over a period of time for anything like this. And once you start to establish a pattern, you're going to notice nuances usually underneath that. And those nuances become at a certain point relatively provable. When a person does and says this, and then they also do and say this, this is the outcome they provide. I know this is not going to be good for me. Now, you have to combine that with your intuition. Our intuitions are actually very real things, and sometimes we ignore them. And sometimes people are bad at their intuitions because an intuition is, gosh, this is probably not a great example, Nico, but it's similar to your conscience. It's only similar. It's not exact. Your conscience can be well-formed. Here is a moral thing, and you must know that this moral behavior, when it is compromised, is bad. I'm forming your conscience. So you know when you do this activity that you might not have thought before of, but you're following a passion, it causes this bad effect. Now we've formed your conscience. Don't do that. Intuition is a little bit different, but it works with our conscience. Why? Well, your conscience tells you not to do something. You shouldn't do it. We should follow our conscience, but we ought to form our conscience, okay? So if our conscience is malformed, it might not be firing off when danger is approaching. So we form it. Our intuition should be listened to and paid attention to. My intuition said, this is a bad situation. I did it anyway. I ignored my intuition and it did go bad. And I did that over and over and over again. And it always goes bad when I do that. So yes, now you're doing two things. You're matching your intuition with your experiential, results. And when you have experience and intuition in combination, they're very seldomly off. They can be, but they're seldomly off. Now, here's a third way for a person to really get good at this. If there's another person who you respect, whose intuition is firing off saying this is bad, and experience is saying this is bad, it is very unlikely that both of you are there. One of the reasons that I love to put really smart, experienced people in the same room and then bring somebody else in that I might be considered working with or a project to work on is that if I have like three or four or five experienced, smart, intuitive people all in the same room and we all react to something the same way, the likelihood of that being off is very, 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 very low. And so I would look at it that way. I would look at experience, I would look at intuition, and I would look at the collective understanding of other people's experience and intuition in order to determine whether or not you're actually interacting with somebody that might be deceiving you. Now, you may not have the luxury of all of those different things, but if you do, you're going to be in pretty good shape.
We have a last question here, Dave. This is pretty lengthy, but I'll try to summarize it as best I can. Dear Dave, I know someone who is also practicing Catholic. He's currently in a role he doesn't like with a low income ceiling, so he knows he has to step out to do something different. However, he doesn't see the need to focus on his income as a primary motivator. In fact, I've heard him say on a few occasions that he questions people who make high levels of income as if they're contradicting the scripture passage that says you cannot serve God and mammon. I'm not sure how to address his concerns, but I can see how this mentality is blocking him from providing for his family. Do you have any tips on how to break him free of this misconception or any comments on that?
Yes. And this is a way easier than most people think from a logical perspective. Let me begin by saying, because I don't know this person, we're not using names. I'm going to say something that's probably a little bit hard to swallow, but this is almost always a self-righteousness. It's almost always an attempt for a person to lower perform, to not as strive for something that they probably should in their life, like their kids and their wife. They need a provider to provide. And the Bible even says that, you know, a man who doesn't provide, right, doesn't work, is as bad as, and maybe we could look up the line, is as bad as an unbeliever. So the idea that providing really matters. Now, it doesn't say a man who doesn't provide just a little bit, less than what they need, or I should say it this way. They don't say a man who provides less than what they need just a little bit is better than the man who provides everything they need. It is not in there. There's no cutoff in the Bible for wealth. Okay. It is the love of money that is the root of all evil. Okay. There are some very, very wealthy saints. What did they do? They became magnanimous and magnificent. To be magnificent is actually to use your money for good things, okay? So you just have to erase this as a competition altogether. It is never a competition. If it were, the Bible would very simply say, hey, if you're making between $25,000 and $50,000 a year, you're going to go to heaven. If you're making between $100,000 and $200,000, well, you can make it to heaven, but you're going to spend 1,000 years in purgatory. If you're making over $1 million, then you're going to hell. No, and it doesn't have it doesn't break out how big your house can be. 3,000 square feet and under, you're fine. Over 3,000, you're going to hell. These things are not a part of anything there. It's to be detached from them that matter. The other thing, too, is we have to ask, what is your role in life? Who do you provide for? If you only provide for yourself in a simple way, you can go about life without having to make a whole lot of money at all. But if you provide for yourself and others, and they have particular needs, they're counting on you. And you can't just look at them and say, I know you're hungry, but we're simple, good Christians, not like those evil people across the street who can actually eat and feed their family, who live in a nice car or a house and whose car doesn't break down. Look at how bad they are because their car doesn't break down when they go out to eat and come back into their comfortable beds. They're really bad people. I mean, this is a horrible thing to actually say, because at some point in life, that person is usually asking their wealthy neighbor for money to get by. And how are they judging them and then thanking them? You can't possibly do the same at the same time. So just, it's nonsense. It is nonsense when people do this. And we also have to think proportionally. Here's another way of looking at this. This particular person, if he were in Africa or Thailand, would be the richest person there. I mean, people would think you are absolutely loaded. So then by comparison to people in Thailand, is he bad? Is he evil? In order for him to be good, does he have to reduce his income to $100 a month? No, there's no cutoff. This is a silly argument. Let's not be in it. Let's say God gave me a particular amount of skill and he gave me a particular talent and a particular calling. I'm going to maximize that. The other thing too that I love is, you know, money is in the hands of good people or bad people. I want it to be in the hands. I just gave a speech actually to a group of men at a university the other day. And I said this to them. I said, make as much money as you possibly can. Now, according to who you are, if you're called to be a teacher, be the best at it and make whatever you can. If you're going to make $50,000, spend $40,000. If you make $100,000, spend $90,000. If you make $1 million, spend $900,000. But don't spend more than you earn. That's going to be the problem. That's where the problems actually start to come in. But the reason I'm saying go out there and make as much money as you possibly can is because when you have that money, you can do really good things and you can make good decisions. I mean, Elon Musk was fed up with media. So he bought a media company in order to turn the tide. Wow, that's pretty awesome. That's pretty magnanimous. How many of us are sitting on the sidelines saying, I wish I could have done that? Well, in some way you can. And the more resources you have, the more good you can do. But if you have a problem with attachment and you identify yourself with your car, now you run the risk. And that's probably the person who shouldn't. If you're like, I am my watch, I am my car, I am equal to the label that I have, you're suffering from a vice, which might particularly for you mean that you are not called to be around that sort of wealth because that's a temptation that you personally struggle with. But let's not make this a blanket statement for other people.
Yeah, valuable insights, Dave, not to pin two good things against one another. And you've touched on that in the past here. This wraps up our Q&A segment here at the Dave Durand Show. And it actually wraps up our entire show here for this week. We invite you to send any questions over to Dave at DaveAtLeadingGiants.com. Go ahead and follow him on LinkedIn and check out our YouTube channel, Durand On Demand.
Tune in next week to the Dave Durand Show on Relevant Radio, Saturdays at 1 p.m. Central Time, and the podcast version is available 1 hour after airing. We'll see you all next week. God bless.